Chapter 26. Planet Mondona 3. 4 days into Operation Ringbreaker.
The Thunderstrike and Apollonus Promise flew in such tight proximity that their shields bumped and clashed, coruscating through the visible spectrum and releasing enough energy to atomize any TIE fighter that passed through their field. Any squadron that attempted to weave between the rebel vessels was destroyed as surely as if it had been crushed between their hulls. But for every starfighter that disappeared in a green-white cloud of burning oxygen and Tabana gas, 100 more swarmed into the rebels' path. The Promise had already pulled its X-wings out of the fray rather than sacrifice them in an unwinnable dogfight. Twilight's volleys could only thin the enemy masses, not disperse them. And if there was hope for the two vessels that plunged toward the blue-gray oceans of Mardona 3's southern hemisphere, that hope lay in speed, not firepower. The Thunderstrike's bridge trembled and bucked as it skimmed atmosphere. Namir gripped the railing of the command platform until the knuckles of his dark skin began to pale. Chalice smiled tightly at his side. Her own arm looped more casually about the rail. "You look nervous," she said. "I'm normally on a dropship for these things," Namir said. "It's a lot more worrying when you can see what's causing the bumps." "You should have been on the bridge during Coyote," Chalice replied with a shrug. Namir thought he heard an edge to her tone and wondered if she was feigning calm for him or for the crew. "We'll be fine. Won't we, Commander?"
"More than fine," came the call. "We'll be majestic. Laughing Seahawks diving for prey."
Commander Tona was a transfer from the Promise. A squat ball of muscle and a former helmsman who'd arrived to take charge of the bridge crew and run the Thunderstrike. He'd come with high praise from the Promise's officers. But Namir didn't yet know what to expect from the man. It had been Tona and the Promise crew who'd devised the insertion onto Mardona during the planning meetings, after Chalice had assured them that no warships would be present and that Twilight's largest worries would be ion cannons on the surface and satellite defenses in orbit. Thus the plan to accelerate rapidly toward the planet and dive swiftly into Mardona's atmosphere over water, beneath the satellites and out of range of the continental cannons. Something metallic rumbled in the hull, but Tona didn't seem concerned.
"We've outrun most of the fighters," he said. "Dropships can go on your command."
"Go!"
Namir snapped. The men and women at the bridge stations tapped at their consoles or spoke into their links. The Thunderstrike rumbled again as its hangars opened onto Mardona's gray storm clouds. Chalice unlooped her arm from the rail and stepped closer to Namir, lowering her voice.
"Your squads know the mission," she said. "If we don't make it down, the operation won't be compromised."
Between her rasp and the ship's roar, he struggled to comprehend her words.
"I know," he said. "We're going anyway."
Mardona 3 was, by Chalice's scorn-ridden description, a warehouse world. Not a bustling trade port or a production facility, but a place for the Empire to stockpile equipment and materials for delivery to nearby systems in times of need. The warehouse worlds were part of a larger Imperial initiative to allow for rapid reallocation of resources and to eliminate dependency on outdated trade routes. More important, they were a vulnerability the Alliance hadn't yet learned to exploit. The mega spaceport that served as Mardona's primary warehousing hub consisted of dozens of enormous black metal buildings that rose from the rocky surface. They were almost crystalline in design, cuboids with their sides perfectly sheared at odd angles. The buildings extended deep underground, where the main storage facilities were contained and where an elaborate system of tramways allowed automated transfer of goods according to shipping schedule and projected needs. The entire megaport was large enough to house millions, but its systems were largely mechanized. A few 100,000 dock workers and administrators and droid controllers were enough to keep the warehouse world running. If Twilight Company could disrupt the planet's operations, upend Mardona's ability to supply its neighbors, the Empire would have no choice but to make new accommodations, scramble for other ways to maintain the flow of resources. Personnel and security would need to be reallocated to conventional trade routes. Chalice had shown Namir schematics, star charts, explained how a pebble could become an avalanche. The Moffs themselves wouldn't recognize the Kuat shipyard's degradation until it was too late. But Chalice knew the workings of the machine. Efficiency, she said, is predictability. The Empire is nothing if not efficient. War, however, was neither efficient nor predictable. After the drop ships had landed and the Thunderstrike had fled the star system, the company's first 12 hours on Mardona were spent descending from the surface and stealing through the tram tunnels. Once the squads had entered the underground, they made no attempt to hold open routes to the surface. Instead, dozens of strike teams sabotaged tramways, disabled surveillance equipment, and ambushed security forces independently, spontaneously splitting and merging and regrouping. They were rats infesting the machinery, too dispersed to exterminate easily. When the Empire shut down power to the underground in a 5-block radius, forcing the soldiers to switch to night vision goggles and personal respirators, it was a temporary measure only. Twilight's attacks continued elsewhere, and shutting down a whole section of the spaceport inhibited the Empire as much as it did the enemy. Namir fired his weapon only once, when his two escort squads were ambushed by a swarm of spidery maintenance droids, each a fist-sized sphere with magnetized legs and a welding torch. The machines scuttled over rails and across ceilings, racing to sear their victims. Aside from a few minor burns and the promise of a sleepless night, the squads emerged from the ambush intact. During the next 12 hours of the company's attack on Mardona, the real work began. Even discounting the ongoing repairs to the Thunderstrike, Twilight's engineering crew had been busy since leaving Uncurl. Each squad had come to Mardona armed with 24 ion mines, crudely improvised explosives mass-produced by the crew from batteries, motion sensors, and whatever casings were available. The mines came in duffel bags and sheared-off piping, in food containers and cracked helmets. They were, in Brand's words, glue for Mardona's gears. The squads planted the devices at junctions, along kilometer-long tram lines, and at the entrances to underground warehouses. It was one duty Namir could participate in without taking on more risk than his subordinates would suffer. He listened to the distorted sound of blaster shots echo in the tunnels, as may Diyu, the woman who treated him with almost unbearable deference since he'd saved her from burning to death outside Chalice's cell, gripped the soles of his boots and boosted him to the level of the tunnel's lower pipework. With a graceless grunt, he clambered onto a broad metal conduit and reached down as May Diyu passed him a tattered backpack and a roll of adhesive tape. "Here!" he called toward Chalice, who watched with arms folded, a dozen paces and a shortfall away. "Farther down," Chalice said. "Let the tram car build speed." Namir shrugged and crawled along the length of the pipe. May Diyu followed directly below, holding her rifle at the ready. When Namir and Chalice had linked up with her squad, she'd appointed herself their personal bodyguard. She was attentive and cautious, good at her job. Namir missed Gadrin and Roach and Charmer and Brand, but Charmer had his own squad full of fresh meat now. The others were needed on the offensive, striking at security posts, keeping the Empire distracted while the mines were planted. Namir looped the tape around the bag, tried to keep it out of view from the track. He jostled it, made sure it was secure, then slipped a hand into the bag and felt for a button. He pictured a tram car turning the corner and the mine detonating as it passed below. Ion mines didn't deliver much concussive force, but the explosion would fry any circuits in the car and the surrounding tunnel. The vehicle might derail or not. Either way, It would block the route until a maintenance crew removed it. By the time Twilight Company was off Mardona, there would be thousands of ion mines planted through the tram network. It would take months for the Empire to clear them all, and during that time, the whole system would need to be shut down. It was a clever plan, devised by Chalice and the engineers and the squad leaders. But clever could go wrong very fast. On the second full day of Twilight's attack on Mardona 3, Namir ordered the squads to cluster in the tunnels below one of the Megaport's housing blocks. Reports had come in overnight of Imperial armored vehicles descending into the tramways, sweeping through whole sectors. Any squad caught in such a sweep was doomed. Twilight couldn't afford to stop mining, but teams in the field needed a fallback position. A housing block was a safe choice, a reasonable choice, likely to contain food, water, and computer resources a warehouse would not. Namir listened to Gadrin and Mizoon's and Zab's concerns about risking civilian lives and chose to proceed anyway. A dozen squads poured into the block at once, surrounding the perimeter and demanding the residents retreat to their apartment pods. There was no resistance. The civilians were unarmed and unprepared for an attack, and those too stunned to react were ushered back into their homes by Twilight soldiers. With the halls cleared, the squad sealed off all but a handful of entrances and posted sentries down the tunnels. Charmer's team was the first to venture back out. Chalice volunteered to speak to the residents while Namir saw to the block's defenses, setting up barricades and kill zones. "I'm used to dealing with people like this," she said. "Just give the word." "If I put you in charge of civilians," Namir said, "the recruits from Hedora will beat me to death in my sleep. I'll handle it." Chalice didn't argue, and he was grateful. One resident from each floor was brought from his or her pod to the block's education center, where the meeting could be broadcast to every apartment. When Namir arrived, half the civilians began shouting as soon as he walked in. The others stared in horror or whispered to their neighbors to be silent. When he started to talk, however, they all listened. Having Mediu at his back, rifle in hand, likely helped. "We're not here to hurt you," he said. "Believe me when I say you're the least of our concerns. Tomorrow morning, anyone who wants to leave will be escorted into the tunnels. Trams are shut down, but hopefully your governor will accommodate you. If you don't want to brave the tunnels or your family isn't up for the trip, we won't force you out. If you want to stay, keep your pod doors sealed. Don't attempt to communicate with the outside, and we won't be responsible for your safety if the Empire attacks." It wasn't an inspiring speech, but it wasn't intended to be. Namir needed the civilians out of the way and at least a little cowed. If they tried to sabotage Twilight's operation from inside the apartment block, the situation would turn messy fast. There were questions, practical ones mostly, about access to food and medicine. A withered, yellow-bearded old man wanted to know if residents could speak to their neighbors within the block. A squat young woman eloquently described how she'd come to Mardona on the promise of work and good pay, and begged the Rebel Alliance to leave for a world where it was wanted. A stern, balding dock worker wanted to know what would happen to residents who hadn't been home during the attack, who might try to return. "My son is out there," he said. "Do you plan to shoot him when he comes for me?" Namir answered as well as he could for half an hour before a runner informed him he was needed elsewhere. He waved away the remaining questions and had the civilians escorted back to their pods. He didn't intend to ignore them, but he still had a company to run and a planet to ruin. By the fourth day of the attack, Namir was stewing irritably in the claustrophobic embrace of the housing block. While the squad slipped out through maintenance shafts and air ducts to continue mining the tramways or defended the barricades against periodic Imperial assaults, he was stuck in the administrative office Twilight had converted into a command center. He studied maps and data pads and listened to sentry reports, and kept his muscles busy by pacing a meter from Chalice's desk. The governor seemed untroubled by her surroundings. More than untroubled at times. When they were alone together, Namir sometimes saw her staring, apparently oblivious to the world, into a blank screen. Those were the only moments he remembered the husk she'd been after returning from Hoth, and she always returned to her more vibrant self as soon as she sensed his attention. Those moments, and whenever he saw her suppress a cough. The civilians who'd chosen to remain proved a persistent distraction. Barely an hour went by when Namir wasn't forced to deal with a resident sneaking between apartment pods, or requesting additional food supplies, or reporting a neighbor for possessing a blaster. One of Twitch's team members was caught stealing jewelry and loose credits from an abandoned pod. Namir didn't especially care, but he scolded the man publicly for the sake of keeping peace. A family that had come to blows, Namir had no idea why, needed to be forcibly separated and locked in separate pods. "We're not your blasted police," he muttered more than once. Yet the overall operation was proceeding apace. Every day the Imperials sealed off more entrances into the tunnels, and every day Chalice discovered alternatives in city blueprints or Brand scouted fresh routes. The housing block was buried deep enough to be defensible against heavy vehicular attacks, and if the Empire used large-scale weapons against the block, it would collapse half the Megaport's tunnels in the process. Squads continued their mine-laying every hour, returning to the block exhausted and filthy and eager to resupply. Namir took satisfaction in that. He tried not to show it. At the end of the fourth day, Namir was picking at the contents of a meal tray, some sort of mashed tubers, flavorless but superior to the Thunderstrike's fare, when he was summoned to one of the block's upper floors to deal with a discipline problem involving a squad member in an empty pod. Another looter, Namir thought, and dragged himself through the block's maze-like passages. The only decorations were whatever tiny portraits or icons or sprigs of plant life the residents dared post on their pod doors. Life under the Empire was bleak, Namir supposed, but it didn't look uncomfortable. The source of the discipline problem became obvious as soon as he reached the 12th floor. A rhythmic bass caused the walls to thrum, and he followed the noise down a hallway and around a corner. Gadrin, smiling toothily, stood across from a pod door. "You called your commanding officer here for this?" Namir asked. He had to nearly shout to be heard over the pounding.
"She is your protege," Gadrin said, and shrugged his massive shoulders. "Your squad may now belong to me, but I did not wish to overstep."
Namir glowered at Gadrin, then stepped to the entryway. When the door slid open, the hall flooded with sound, not just the bass, but eerie notes spawned by instruments Namir couldn't imagine, human and alien voices mixed in incomprehensible song. Namir's bones ached at the vibrations, and as he walked into the apartment, over the stained yellow rug and past a table covered in glass animal statuettes, he saw the woman responsible. Red hair, matted with sweat, barefoot yet otherwise garbed in full combat gear. Roach danced with wild enthusiasm, swinging and twisting her gangly body about the living room. It was nearly a minute before she noticed Namir. When she did, she grinned shamelessly and slapped a hand against the audio controls in the wall. The music stopped. "This isn't your home," Namir said. "Try to have some dignity."
"There were complaints about the volume," Gadrin added behind him.
"But I can stay, right?" Roach asked.
She was still smiling. Namir couldn't remember ever seeing her smile.
He couldn't remember her ever looking like a child before.
You can stay, Namir said. Keep a channel open in case your squad needs you.
Gadrin followed him back outside the pod. When the door closed, he laughed in his alien bellow.
I know you have other duties,
he said, clasping a leathery hand on Namir's shoulder.
I know that you are supremely important, but I thought you deserved to see that.
You're a monster, Namir said.
He felt lighter as he returned to the command center. His good mood lasted a full hour until a message came in from the sentries. Charmer's team had been ambushed during a mining run. Only one of his squad had survived.
Corbo's arms were wrapped and bandaged by the time Namir reached him. The young man from Hadoral was lying on a bed in the company's makeshift hospital, an apartment scrubbed clean and staffed by a pair of twilight medics. Corbo shivered on his back as he told his story. Charmer's squad had been attacked by an armored Imperial vehicle. Not a tank or a walker, but a segmented metal worm that glided on repulsors and sped along the tramways. It had been armed with flame weapons and stun beams. Anything more powerful, Namir suspected, would risk collapsing the tunnels. Charmer had barely ordered the others to run before being incinerated. Namir didn't press Corbo for details of the fight or how he'd escaped. As Corbo stumbled over half-recalled horrors, Namir asked him simply, "You're sure the others were killed, not captured?"
"Yes," Corbo said.
Namir felt something heavier and sicklier than relief congeal in his stomach, something that replaced doubt with focus, but pressed on his gut nonetheless.
"Then get some rest," he said. "We'll avenge them."
Three Twilight soldiers had died during the previous days of running and hiding and planting mines. Now three had died in one night. Namir wasn't sure if it was his own restlessness or the soldiers he sensed as he walked through the apartment block. Not until Brand found him in the kitchen they'd turned into an armory.
"We haven't hit back. Really hit back since Coyote," she said. "If you want to hurt them, you won't be short on volunteers."
"We'll hurt them," Namir said.
He clipped a pair of spare power packs to his belt, patted himself down to ensure his equipment was secure.
"Tomorrow, we get back to work. But tonight..."
"Does Chalice know you're going?" Brand asked.
"I owe it to Charmer."
"It was a question," Brand said. "Not an argument."
Two teams went hunting for the machine that had burned three soldiers alive. Brand took point, scouting for enemy patrols or trace energy signatures. A machine so large running on repulsors might leave a footprint. The others found out from the ambush location, sweeping an arc through the tunnels behind Brand. Most of the hunters had known Charmer well. Carver, who'd been classmates with Charmer at the Imperial Academy. Namir and Brand, of course. Twitch came at Namir's request. He needed soldiers with heavy weapons expertise to take down the machine. Medea was there for Namir. Gadrin was elected to stay behind. Namir had rejected the idea of bringing more fresh meat. The Hadol recruits had been friends with Corbo and the dead men, but they didn't have the experience for a death squad. The teams intercepted the worm as its crew was disembarking outside an Imperial sentry post. The heavy weaponry wasn't necessary. The enemy officers were caught in a storm of blaster fire. If any survived, they didn't last under the savage kicks and stomps of the squad members. A single grenade lobbed through the machine's hatch brought the worm to the ground, spewing chemical fumes and crackling with electrical arcs. By the time the sentries inside the Imperial outpost were ready to reinforce their allies, the squad's mission was done. But Namir didn't call for a withdrawal until the weight of the reinforcements became too great, until the Twilight teams had killed a dozen more officers and stormtroopers and exacted the price for a squad's decimation. Bodies were heaped at the gates of the sentry post when Namir and his colleagues finally fled into the tunnels. Back at the housing block, the company members still awake, and there were many, even in the quiet hours before dawn, cheered the squad's return. Some of the soldiers who'd taken part in the mission went on to the cafeteria to share triumphant stories over breakfast. Brand promised to bring word to Corbo and Roach. Another contingent of soldiers had been searching apartments, convinced one of the residents had been feeding information to the Empire, resulting in the ambush of Charmer's squad. They'd found a transmitter with the yellow-bearded old man who'd spoken at the first civilian meeting and beaten him half to death before Gadrin had intervened. "I'll take care of it," Chalice told Namir as he returned his equipment to the armory. She'd given him the whole story on his arrival. She hadn't said a word about his participation in the death squad. He didn't want to care, but he made himself ask. "How?" "We'll sweep his apartment, drain his accounts, and if he owns anything useful, add it to Hoba's inventory. Burn the rest. Leave him with nothing. Not even food or clothing. And send him into the tunnels." Enough to appease anyone who wanted blood, Namir thought, but not so harsh as to leave soldiers like Gadrin with a lasting grudge. "Good enough," he said. He went back to his quarters, an apartment pod that had apparently once belonged to a collector of vintage mechanical clocks, and slept. He was in charge of Twilight Company. His friend had died under his command, and he'd made it right. That had to suffice for the night. Leaving Mardona 3 was no simpler than arriving. Chalice had given the company 6 days for the mission, after which Imperial reinforcements would arrive to cut off its escape. Even staying that long, she'd insisted, would be a risk. Namir signaled for the Thunderstrike and a pilotless promise to return for pickup on the evening of the fifth day. The company had laid 4/5 of the ion mines. That would have to be enough. The squads dispersed again, abandoning the housing block and seeking lightly guarded egresses onto the surface. Mardona security forces were prepared, and all the exits guarded, as Twilight had known they would be. The squad's timing would need to be precise. They had to surface during the brief window in which the Thunderstrike and its dropships were in the planet's atmosphere. If the squads arrived on the surface too early, they'd be exposed and overrun by Imperials. Too late, and they'd be left behind when the Thunderstrike was forced to flee. Namir expected the extraction to be bloody and desperate. He expected to lose as many as 3 or 4 squads, maybe a dropship as well. Instead, mere hours before the squads were scheduled to ascend, rain began falling on the Megaport. Thick, heavy drops whipped northward by the wind pelted buildings and sensors and sentries. Clouds blocked out sunlight. Even electronically enhanced vision became useless. The streets began to flood and water trickled into the tunnels. The squads made their final ascent through mist and gale, slogging up slick steps and climbing cargo lift shafts. Namir's soaked boots clung to his toes, and he fired wildly into the darkness toward the enemy. Victory was impossible in a squall of such force, but Twilight Company didn't need victory. It only needed to push forward to reach the dropships that rocked wildly against the wind. The storm saved Twilight Company. The squads escaped Mardona 3 with 1 fatality and a handful of injuries. The Thunderstrike resumed its course for Kuat.
"Sergeant Paul Andrissus," Hoba proclaimed.
It was Charmer's real name, though Namir couldn't remember ever hearing it said aloud. Carver and Gadrin had argued over who would eulogize Charmer at the funeral. Gadrin had ultimately conceded, and it was Carver who approached Hoba in the charging station, handed over the blaster power pack ready to be drained.
"Ladies' man," Carver declared,
and there was nervous laughter throughout the crowded vehicle bay. Was that how Charmer would want to be remembered?
Namir wasn't sure. It seemed mean-spirited after what had happened on Black Tarsist, after the fight that had stolen Charmer's good looks, after the shrapnel in his brain had cost him his ability to form a sentence without stammering. But then, Charmer had never given up the nickname either. Namir hadn't ever asked him about it. He swore softly under his breath. Carver withdrew and Hober went on to the next name. Namir felt a grip on his arm, flinched, and turned to see Roach beside him, watching him with obvious concern. He forced a smile and gently removed her hand. Seven names, seven dead. Seven batteries drained and eulogies delivered. He'd seen plenty of friends and comrades die before. Yet he felt cold and clammy, like he was still drying off from the storm on Mardona 3. When the ritual was over, Hober stepped away from the charging station. Instead of ending the broadcast of the ship, however, he paused as Governor Chalas edged her way among the soldiers and emerged into the clearing. Namir hadn't even known Chalas was present. He hadn't seen her at the start of the ceremony, but she dressed for the occasion, wearing a black suit she must have scavenged on Mardona and an ornamental kerchief. She murmured something to Hober, who hesitated a moment before moving aside.
"I'll be brief,"
she said to the crowd. Her voice was too rusty to hear easily, and the soldiers seemed to go rigid as they strained to listen. Namir saw more than a few of them scowling, though most seemed merely puzzled. The men and women who died on Mardona, I didn't know them well. I barely knew them at all. Twitch turned her back on Chalas and pushed her way out of the bay. Chalas seemed not to notice and continued.
"What I do know," she said, "is what the rebellion means to all of you. Captain Ivan showed me by his own example when he welcomed me aboard. I saw the rebellion's heart firsthand when I served with High Command. The soldiers who died on Mardona 3 did so believing the rebellion was worthy of their dedication. They weren't there because of orders. They believed that a great victory, even in these dark days, was still possible. I intend to do whatever is necessary to prove them right. I'm not claiming that's enough," she added swiftly. "We're different from the Empire because every life means something. Our soldiers aren't faceless stormtroopers, but our friends and lovers. Our dead were rebels, yes, and they were lady killers and jokers, and they struggled with their own demons. I intend to fight for victory not because it's enough." Here she paused, surveying the room, eyes skimming over her audience. "But because it's the least we can do to honor the fallen." She smiled then, a small, sad, tight smile, and bowed her head, returning to the crowd. The company member's response was muted, but Namir heard soft affirmation, saw heads nod.
"Onward to victory,"
a man's voice muttered. Namir didn't see who spoke, but he thought it sounded like Hober.
"I didn't mean to upstage you, you know that. I just thought they needed to hear..."
Namir smiled bitterly and shook his head.
"It's fine," he said.
He sat on the trunk in Hal's quarters, watching the governor as she perched at the edge of the bunk. "You're probably right. A little inspiration is good for them."
"Next time," Chalas said.
She took a swig from a bottle of brandy, not unlike the one she'd first brought aboard the Thunderstrike, and passed it to Namir.
"You get the next speech, even if I have to write it myself."
Namir turned the bottle over in his hands and wondered where Chalas had found it. The influx of contraband after Ankural could turn out to be a problem. He'd gone to the clubhouse after the funeral. He hadn't been unwelcome, and he'd stayed long enough to listen to a few stories, hear about Charmer's heroism on Tokut and the shore leave incident on Sigma Station. But conversations had a tendency to stop when he walked by. Bottles got hidden behind support beams. No, he thought. The problem wasn't that the troops were uncomfortable around him. The problem was that anything he said seemed trivial, like an abdication of responsibility for his part in the deaths. And he didn't have any speeches to give, any words of wisdom or solace for grieving friends. He could lead the squads of Twilight Company. He would try to lead them. But he had nothing to say to them when they mourned. He couldn't take part in the grieving when he was also the cause. So he'd come to Chalice, and she'd welcomed him. "Next time," he agreed. "We did well, though," she said. "It'll be a while before we know what resources the Empire cannibalizes on Kuat to make up for Mardona, but that's my problem. You got them in and out alive. Mostly. I watched. The squads did the work." "Welcome to command," Chayla said. She smirked and retrieved the bottle from Namir's hands, taking another quick swallow. "Speaking of which, you should rest. You don't get time off between missions anymore." Namir grunted and rose from the trunk. Chalice mirrored him rising from the bed. She crossed the door before he could intercept and gestured to the bunk. "Yours," she said. He started to argue and got a glower in return. "I already moved my many possessions into Sargon's old quarters. It's past time you started staying here." "We could seal the door," Namir said. "Make sure nobody gets the room." "Do you really want to bunk with your men?" Chalice asked. Her tone made it clear what answer she expected. "Do you really think they're better off with the commander in the next bed over?" Namir watched Chalice a while. She seemed to be holding back a smile. "Get the hell out of my quarters," he said at last. And she laughed as she departed.